Tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
On the next episode of NeuroEmergent, I talk with Leah Blankenship, founder of the Neurodiversity Alliance at the University of Oregon.
Running a group entirely with neurodivergent people, it comes with its own challenges. So much of what defines academic success for these students is just being a successful adult.
Join us at 11 a.m. Wednesday, August 27th for a conversation about neurodiversity from a Gen Z perspective.
There was a mole in the ground. I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour, a program of social and political commentary from a socialist, feminist, anti-racist, and anti-colonial point of view. I'm John Nelson. Today, Desiree Hellegers brings us part two of the 2017 interview with Tim Norgren of the Thin Green Line is People Project. Courtney Neubauer from 2019 and the Rural Roots Rising podcast interviews three rural organizers about how they got their start. And finally, Fran Michel shares a well-read read from Kelly Hayes about obstacles to organizing and the importance of connecting with others. To begin this morning, here's the second part of that Tim Norgren interview, which Desiree Hellegers began last week on the Old Mole Variety Hour from the Thin Green Line is People Project in 2017. Here's climate activist Tim Norgren for KBOO Community Radio.
Do you feel like there's anything unique in the Pacific Northwest that makes it uniquely well situated for, you know, this kind of organizing or this kind of resistance?
You know, I grew up in Michigan, but I was curious, you know, what's out there. So I got to travel, and I traveled the country pretty extensively and settled between two places in the country I wanted to live, one being Vermont, which happens to have some beautiful land and some mountains and a lot of people who are thinking about what's going on and who are willing to do something to improve lives for themselves. And the Northwest, where there's a similar thing. And so I settled in the Northwest. Winters aren't as harsh, and there's more of that beauty, both natural landscape and connectivity with people who are willing to have those conversations, to dialogue amongst each other, to communicate and really figure out what's going on and then do something about it. So that has definitely made a climate where change is ripe for happening. We're also situated in a place where, just given the geography of the country, I suppose this is a place that we are one seaboard over here, though, you know, so all these landlocked fossil fuel projects have to make it over to other countries where, you know, the workers are oppressed and where they can burn these things without retribution or without having to pay so much money for any kind of regulation. They have to get through us. And so here's this great mix of people who are just slightly more empowered, or greatly more empowered. I thought when I went to Texas I was going to be able to do something down there, and ended up being kind of swallowed up by just this apathy and the different attitude. I mean, it's Texas has a huge for-profit prison system that keeps, at least it was, about 10% of the male population of any race was in the legal system in some way, you know, whether it be on probation or parole or in a prison or a jail. So for you to put a line across Texas is a lot more difficult when it comes to getting up the numbers, whereas here I've seen us get together even as a relatively small portion of the people here and blockade an entire coast, keep these terminals from happening in one spot after another all up and down this coast. They keep getting put out there, you know, in Washington, Oregon, California, up in BC, and one by one people get together and fight them off. And if nothing else, this is training for other movements in other places. You know, the East Coast has had its share of things, and there are people resisting in Texas. It's growing out of necessity, I think. But I think specifically here, we've got a huge land to keep. We've got an entire coast that's right on the Pacific Ocean, right there across from all these countries that want a cheap fix. Well, the countries don't. The people there don't. People are killed for resisting, but they're resisting there too. So maybe our actions are going to keep some of those people from dying. So that's in itself a responsibility. But yeah, I think we've got a huge opportunity and a huge responsibility just being where we are in geographical terms and being where we are in the fact of our privilege, what we have.
You've been to a lot of hearings, testified while it's now. Yeah, do you want to talk about that experience? And I mean, earlier you were talking about feeling really shy initially and being able to stand up there and do it. And now what's that like for you to go to those hearings?
Yeah, so being part of this line that we have, it sometimes gets to be something really fun, like direct action, where, you know, you're getting together and you're blocking stuff. And of course, that's what everybody likes to talk about because that's the most adventurous thing. But the truth is, I've had to go to a lot of hearings on these terminals. You know, you've got to go in and go to the state senate or the Congress or just to the Department of Energy's hearings over one terminal or another. And so, you know, early on, that was really tough for me just because I've been kind of a loner and a rebel, as it were. I have been not comfortable in any way with public speaking. So I could literally feel all the blood rushing in my head when I'd get up and speak for my little 2 minutes. And I would tediously write down all of this stuff that I was going to say and then race through it and try and read everything and not look at anybody and get through that. And at some point, I came to realize, not only have I done this a few times now and nothing bad has happened, and the only thing is that I've gotten my expression across, however well or badly it came across. But also that when I didn't write down everything I needed to say, I actually said it better. And so for me, that's been just kind of a personal, okay, write some bullet points and just talk. And so doing that, I've been out and able to think about what I want to say and get it across. Empowering as a human being, just to be able to communicate what's in your heart, but also in doing that, I've been able to hear a lot of other people speak and a lot of points of view from both ends of the issues, and came to find out, you know, as I might have mentioned, that my union leaders were on the other side of that issue, and I found myself speaking opposite them. And so I started focusing on those issues, because when you hear somebody else speak, you've got to counter those arguments. You've got to go, okay, well, what am I going to say next to address that? Because they may say, well, we need energy independence. We need to be free from, you know, having to go to war for oil, because we're so, again, the scarcity thing, we're so needy. We need this energy independence. And to be able to look at that and go, no, we don't. That's a line that's the same carrot on a stick that's going to make us give away our resources. You know, something that when I grew up in the 80s was only for the third world. You know, American companies in the 80s would go in and take the resources of those countries, those poor downtrodden countries that we were never going to be like because we were Americans and wealthy. That's what they did. They went in and took their resources to be manufactured here in America. And that made us superior in whatever mythology was prevalent at the time. But now that's the opposite. Now we're the third world, and everybody seems willing to go along with it because we have to have that energy independence. We're going to extract our resources and ship them over to a manufacturing center somewhere else so that we can be independent. Well, obviously, that's a lie. Obviously, that has changed in the last few years, and the unions are going, well, if we don't do this, then someone else is going to do this. Again, fear, scarcity. If we don't do it, then the non-union, the scabs are going to do it. They're just going to go, and they're still going to export this oil. And communicating across those lines and reasserting the power that we had when we formed these unions is a big deal. So I'm finding myself speaking with other members of my union going, hey, do you remember when we were the IWW, when we were fighting for our basic rights? We have to get back to that because we're giving those rights away. We're becoming the third world so that we can keep a job. That's not what a union is. That's not who we are. That's completely fabricated. The idea that there is a discrepancy between good jobs and environmental sustainability or simply surviving and having a world that our families can live in without fear of famines or droughts, without having to have fracking chemicals dumped into the mainstream farms where we get our food, you know, as they have been in California during these droughts. It's cheaper than buying water because climate change is creating a drought. So these farms are buying up these chemicals, this chemical-laden water. Oh, they'll run it through a charcoal filter and they'll dump it in to these crops. And I'm going, well, are we really willing to just drink poison so that we don't have to fight the same fight we've been fighting for hundreds of years? You know, I mean, like a couple hundred years now, these unions have been standing up for hundreds and hundreds of years. People have been standing up in whatever forms, fighting for basic rights. When I find when I go on the job sites and I have that conversation, overwhelmingly, union members really do have some guts and some pride and really do want to stand up for their families, for their lives, and for their pride as union workers. But then they go back to the dialogue that happens in meetings and where, ironically, you know, the Facebook dialogues, the social media now has been manipulated again by the machine to where union leaders and some of these building trades unions, mine included, are completely just cutting people off who have anything oppositional to say. When I've brought these issues up in social forums, they are shut down as quickly as possible. I've been banned from these pages. Other people have been banned from these pages for saying that, hey, there's something we need to talk about. My question to the unions is, what are we trying to prevent? Are we really trying to prevent a dialogue? Because if you're right that we need these jobs, then someone ought to be able to stand up and make that point in a coherent manner to where other people are going to see that you're right. So if you're right, you have nothing to fear. And it's the same thing that's got me through these nervous sessions and hearings going, you know what? I may not know how to express myself very well yet, but I'm going to learn because I'm right. And when I go in and knowing I'm right, just start talking, all of a sudden I know what to say because it's right. It's just simply a matter of our survival, or it's a matter of us doing jobs that really are good jobs as a union. You know, we're not having to go in and build concentration camps for a dictator because it's the only job out there because we're afraid of scarcity. We're able to say, no, we're not going to build that wall. We're not going to build those concentration camps because we have pride as workers. And nobody seems to want to argue that that's important, that we have that line. But when it comes to the fossil fuel terminals, a lot of people are still not looking it in the eye. They're not looking at the possibility that this is going to kill us and be destroying our families real soon. So, you know, working people are a really key element because, I mean, this wealth that is being hoarded and fought for at the cost of our lives is something that was built by us. I mean, this is everyday people have worked to build all this capital that is now being hoarded. And we have an obligation, we have a right to take that back and also to just make it so that we can survive in this world. I mean, that's more important than any wealth distribution whatsoever. It's just, you know, if you're working that hard, if you're so worried about having a place for your kids and being able to get them to these classes and get them on the team and take them camping in the summer and go on the hunting trip with your son, well, quit working for the oil company and start fighting for something. Stand up against a trade bill that is going to destroy your ability to ever have these things for your family and leave your kids in a place that is war-torn and where famine is the norm, because it's happening. It's already happening. We've got an obligation to do something about that.
Do you want to talk about other movements that you feel like have been particularly important in preparing you for this activism, or other movements that you feel like this movement is related to?
You know, as far as influence on my way of thinking, there are so many people that have done really basic and really powerful work to fight for what in the end is all the same struggle, be it civil rights. The Black Panthers come to mind, who just really did a lot as a relatively small group of people. You had a lot of struggle going on in the streets. I mean, you've got, you know, the ones we hear about, the Martin Luther King, amazing leader, but you get down to the everyday street struggles, the things where people were not only the things that get the press, you know, you hear about the showing of guns and the militant whatever fights and the police and the tear gas and all that stuff that makes the news. But then how much do you hear about the free clinics that were going on with the, be it the Black Panthers or like the Youth International Party, you know, the yippies out and starting in New York started doing the free stores and all these basic things that support the community, with the whole point being that we're here for each other. It's not just a fight against this other thing, but it's also about abundance. It's about growing a garden and sharing it with your neighbors. It's about taking things that are there for the taking in the community and sharing them with people. It's kind of like get back to kindergarten and, hey, let's relearn how to share as a group of people, as a society. So I've seen things like that where people acted communally in activist struggles as a really big and important piece that gets overlooked a lot of the time. And I mean, you see it back even to the turn of the century when the IWW was formed. You see the militant fights and the strikes and whatnot. But then you also see the families where the women got together and fought in these same struggles, or simply had to go somewhere else to, you know, gather resources. And it's funny, it can be used in any context. You've got Rosie the Riveter for World War II, where the home front people got their resources together and pushed it out to the struggle out there. Well, you know, now you've got the same thing going. There's people here in this community in Portland, you know, white folks who are going up to the Unistaten camp to just basically cook food, and people going out to Standing Rock to do these kind of everyday things to support the people who are directly involved in that struggle. Just because someone's got to wash the dishes, you know, someone's got to build shelter, someone's got to keep life going. And so in every movement throughout history, I'm bouncing back and forth in my history here, but you see this basic care of everyday life happening. When the Haymarket happened, when you had this group of union activists fighting for the 8-hour day at a demonstration in Chicago in the Haymarket Square, you had this really violent reaction from the powers that be at the time, and you had all of a sudden agent provocateurs involved in this situation, and a bomb is thrown and people end up dying, you know, on both ends of the protest. There's people just killed. So that we can create a big to-do and an excuse to go to war. It's an excuse to polarize people. And then you see these people, all of a sudden, all the leaders, ironically, of that movement, those wobblies and whatnot, were taken to trial and hanged. And you see the inspiration that came out of that, because a whole another generation, you look at Emma Goldman, who came over from Russia, was so in awe of the Statue of Liberty when she came over here, finally escaping the oppression that was going on in Russia and believing the myths of liberty, of American freedom and justice and all this stuff that we're taught. Here she came over just astounded by it, only to find the same power struggles going on. And seeing the Haymarket inspired her to be at the beginning of, you know, 1900 or the first little bit of that, actually fighting for birth control and a woman's right to choose, things like that. And this woman actually stood up to one of the male leaders of her movement. And, you know, in a way it takes more to stand up against someone you're in your own movement. You know, this guy was a socialist thinker. She was an anarchist. They fought similar battles and definitely worked together as different movements work together now. And she called this guy out because of some hypocrisy and him being oppressive, pulled out a bullwhip in a public place and whipped him into submission under a table. I mean, that is power. I mean, I'm tearing up because this woman was amazing for her time, had so much power just in believing in herself and believing what she was doing was right. She, I recall, was scared to death the first time she spoke in public and became one of the greatest orators of the time, and was hunted down by police all across the country because she would go and speak from the heart and rile people up. And that kind of person is incredibly inspirational to me. She wrote a like 1,000-page autobiography called Living My Life. To see what really goes on, it's really amazing to look at what really happens with some of these people as human beings and what they are able to do and the kind of things that go on in everyday life, being a working class person, working in these as a seamstress in some of these mills that she was forced to work in to survive, and how that everyday, dealing with everyday life and trying to make it better for people, doing things to improve life for people in the community, and really making a stand to the point where she was imprisoned and eventually deported for what she was doing. They go so much hand in hand. Everyday life is not separable from huge acts of resistance. It's just, it's been done and done and done all through history. So here we are, we're doing it, you know. We've just got to keep going with that, keep on doing what we're doing, and do more of it. We're all human.
Is there anything that you feel like you wanted to say that you haven't had a chance to say?
Okay, so, you know, in speaking about the everyday community that is a part of every struggle, I've noticed that seems to happen a lot more with activists for some reason, maybe because we are in touch with a bigger connection, that we have something in common, that we are joined in a common cause. And I guess that goes across lines. I mean, people who are involved in a common struggle tend to unite, whether it's a plane crash and people just surviving or whatever it may be. But for example, going out to Break Free, where we blockaded and created a conversation in a town that has been dominated by some oil refineries up in northern Washington, we not only blockaded by water the barges that came and went from that group of refineries, and succeeded just by our presence, not even having to get out and do anything or have any arrests happen in that particular forum, but, you know, and then blockaded by railroad, where there was, you know, 50 people arrested in military style fashion, you know, on the other end of that. But also the everyday life, just the camp that happened, the conversations that were started up amongst people in town, people who went into town and talked to everyone who lived there and works at the refineries, including one guy who I related to. I met, he'd taken the time off from the work day or the work weekend, where he wanted to come out and see what was going on as a refinery worker, and came to tell me, just as worker to worker, that, hey, my boss is so freaked out by this that we were given all this literature, and they actually spent thousands of dollars to build barracks within the refinery so that we wouldn't have to leave and be corrupted by the influence, or, as they put the fear into us, threatened by these terrorists. And they gave us a list of terrorists. Heading the list happened to be the Raging Grannies, which cracked me up, and I ended up taking a picture of this steel worker named Bill. Took his picture with one of the Raging Grannies, a little old lady with a really friendly attitude and a cool hat on. And he got to send that via his phone back to the folks that he worked with and say, look, this is what you're afraid of. This is what I'm doing today while you're locked in there. And it evidently was pretty powerful for some of the workers there to experience that. But that kind of community was happening, that kind of conversation was happening in town while these, you know, more militant actions were happening. And seeing what happened, not just in town, but in camp, where the activists got together, or just, you know, everywhere, really. Whether we were out getting ready to go out on the water, at base tent, you know, in the parking lot near the dock, or whether we were in camp itself, where we spent several nights together, you would see this complete and utter sharing of everything. I mean, just resources were completely shared. There was no mine or yours. Like, yes, you have a sleeping bag you brought, but, you know, if someone needs to sleep on part of your blankets, it's there. I mean, it's down to the simple act of someone walking up to another group of people with a cup of coffee in their hand that they went and got in town, and just, you know, seeing that other people don't have coffee and just passing that cup around, down to the simple, we're so conditioned to having our Starbucks or whatever in our hand, and this is our little serving cup. But just to see that a sip of coffee is enough to be willing to share, and just, here, it's mine, it's yours, we're in this together. This is not scarcity, this is abundance. We share this thing, and that's the kind of attitude that is so needed and is happening amongst activists. And I see this when we get together and we struggle together. The resource sharing, the heart sharing, the time for emotional needs that people have.
So it sounds like you're saying that that is one of the things that really fuels you and gives you hope in this movement work.
There is definitely inspiration in that sharing among people, because I believe that before we learned this idea that we were separate from each other. That connectedness has been what's kept us going for thousands and thousands of years as a species. And we see it amongst not just humans, but every other species out there. There is some kind of interconnection, and more with some than others. But, you know, yeah, I'm inspired by our interconnected ability to act as a tribe. You know, when Columbus came over to this continent, he wrote back to his leaders in the mother country that these people are so giving, they're so willing to just give you anything that they have, that they could easily be taken and dominated and made to work for us. And the difference in the attitude between what was going on here amongst tribes who were not connected to that mode of thought of having to dominate the natural world and having to take and hoard, those people had everything they needed. They didn't need anything, and so they were willing to give away everything that they had because they knew that they would never do without. And there's all the difference in that attitude, and that's what inspires me as a human animal to just, that's what I want in life. I want to live and share and not be afraid of needing, not be fighting with people I love to have what we all have in the first place.
Connection by the Rolling Stones here on the Old Mole Variety Hour. Up next, a segment from Rural Roots Rising with Courtney Neubauer from 2019. Rural Roots Rising is a podcast for and by rural Oregonians working for strong communities and a just democracy. Neubauer interviews three rural organizers about how they got started for the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO Community Radio.
People raising a ruckus, start making a fuss, start giving a fuck, and get out into the streets, and there may be hope.
My name is Courtney Neubauer. I'm an organizer with the Rural Organizing Project, and I will be your host for this episode. The theme of today's episode is Anyone Can Be an Organizer. We will hear from Brenda Flores with Raices in Stanfield, Umatilla County, Juan Navarro with Here to Stay in the Mid-Willamette Valley, and Monica Pearson with Indivisible North Coast Oregon in Astoria. Both Brenda and Juan were Rural Organizing Fellows, a program focused on building up and supporting rural community organizers, which you will hear them talk about during their interviews. In rural Oregon, we believe in fairness and looking out for our neighbors. Brenda, Juan, and Monica began working with their neighbors because they wanted to create safe communities for all. First, we hear from Brenda.
So I live in a small town in Umatilla County called Stanfield, Oregon. It's really small. Like, there's only one light signal, and there's only, like, one main road, and we have, like, a gas station. It has never grown. I feel like it has a lot of room for growth, and that's one reason why I went back home, because growing up, everyone has that feeling where they're like, oh, I can't wait to leave, and I just want to get out of this area. But then you leave, and then you're like, oh, you know what, I kind of do want to go back. So that's how it was for me. Like, I left, and then I saw everything that was going on in the western side of Oregon, like with organizing for the Latinx community, and I wanted that for the eastern side of Oregon, just because my family's there. And then there's other families that have, like, the same background. So I decided to go back to be closer to my family, see my siblings grow up, and also make a change.
I am Monica Pearson. I am an ROP board member. I live in Astoria, Oregon. Locally, I'm involved with Indivisible North Coast Oregon. I moved to Astoria about 3 years ago from Denver, Colorado. And we actually moved because my husband got a job here. He's the library director in Astoria. That's kind of what keeps us here. I mean, employment, but we also do love it. Like, since we moved here, we moved from a big city and we were a little hesitant what it would be like living in a rural community, but we both love it. We've acclimated very quickly, got super involved in all kinds of things locally, and it really feels like home now.
My name is Juan Navarro, so I'm from the Willamette Valley area. I'm specifically in the Salem area, so a small town outside of Salem. And one of the landscape is just like any other really small town around a big city. It gets this portrayal of being small town, good old American, hardworking, which kind of often translates into very conservative. So I lived in that area since I was 3 years old. So that's almost 24 years. And what brought me here was, well, kind of a little backstory of why I'm here. It went there because I had a lot of family that lived there. And me and my parents immigrated to the United States when I was 3 years old. I needed 6 surgeries to kind of be able to walk. And through the grapevine, they were able to find healthcare options for me to get the surgeries and not go bankrupt in Portland. So we decided to station ourselves in Oregon. Originally, we weren't supposed to stay in Oregon that long. I was just supposed to get the surgeries, go back to Mexico, be good. But at that time, I already knew English. I was already doing really well in school. My siblings were born in the United States, so we already had a mixed status family. And my parents were starting to get decent paying jobs for not being citizens. And that's kind of what kept me there. As a youth, being in a town that doesn't reflect what you value, it's very hard to really love it. And for now, I don't really want to go back and organize there. But now I'm slowly, as I've been a fellow, been more comfortable coming back to the area and like advocating and becoming the fullest of myself to transform that area into what it could be. My siblings still are in the area, and I know that I have to organize as much as I can to make their experiences a lot better than mine were.
In 2018, Oregon voted down ballot measure 105, which tried to repeal Oregon's sanctuary law. The law prevents the use of local resources for federal immigration policies and protects against unfair targeting, interrogating, and detaining of Oregonians simply because they are perceived to be undocumented. Rural Oregonians were able to defeat Measure 105 by talking with their neighbors about how it takes years and thousands of dollars to get legal immigration status in this country. For those who are in the country without legal status, there is no way under our current system to gain legal residency, even if they have lived here most of their life, are married to a U.S. citizen, or have citizen children. Carrying the momentum from that victory forward, communities across the state lobbied their legislators to successfully pass driver's licenses for all in June 2019. The ability to drive legally is a core everyday need, especially for rural Oregon families as we take our kids to school, commute to work, and get groceries where there is often little to no public transit available. This legislation will make Oregon roads safer because driver's licenses will be accessible to everyone who is tested and insured. We began with Brenda, who worked on these policies as part of her project during the Rural Organizing Fellowship.
So my project was to create an organization in the area because a lot of organizations that do a lot of immigrant rights are all in like the western side of Oregon, so Portland and Salem. And there's no movement in our area, like the eastern side, Umatilla County. And in that area, there's a lot of farm workers and who are immigrants as well. So they don't have that kind of representation. I decided with my project, I wanted to start up an organization because whenever I did ask organizations to come down to the Umatilla County, they never wanted to because they said that it was too far or they didn't have connection. And it's like, well, you have me as a connection, so we can still do something. But they always had like excuses. So I was kind of fed up about that. So Raices isn't affiliated with the one from Texas, because there's one in Texas that we didn't know about. But the reason why we chose that name is because Raices mean roots. And in our area, it's agriculture, so roots ties up. And also everyone in our organization or grassroots organization, we all grew up there. Like, we all came back to our roots because we all went to college and then we just came back. So then we thought it would be a perfect name for our group. I found a group of people who kind of had the same idea when we started organizing for Measure 105 to vote against Measure 105, because in Independence, Oregon, I believe there's 3 Latino citizens eating at a restaurant and a cop racially profiled them, arrested them, and said that they were undocumented, and they weren't. So one of the persons like sued them, and in our area, it's well known that the Umatilla County Sheriff is very against immigrants and he has a lot of strong Republican views. So we felt like that was definitely going to affect our people, and they're already afraid to be driving around.
I don't know if it was the first time I was organizing, but it's the first time I organized in Oregon. And I actually was, it was the first time that I was in charge of it. Like, I'd helped with other events before, but I was the main person for organizing it was with ROP, to do a Know Your Rights session. So it involved like finding a venue and, you know, all the logistics of it and the marketing. And so that is the first time, and it was little scary. Like, I had no idea what I was doing. All I had was like the name of a person that had a movie theater that might let us use it. So I kind of went from there, but then it really did kind of become easy. And then once you do that once and you know a person, then it made it easier. Like, the next time we had events, like, I kind of very quickly started networking and figuring out like who to call or who knew somebody. And I do think in rural towns it's almost easier to network, because you're pretty much always going to know somebody that knows somebody, or, you know, like they know of a guy, or, and you can usually figure out a way to get connected to them. And because I think we're all small town too, people are way more willing. Like, we do all of our organizing here. We have no budget. We have absolutely no, like, there's never money involved at all, but people are just willing to sponsor us. And, you know, we have meetings at local restaurants, and, you know, us buying coffee is kind of our rent for using the space, kind of thing. So, and I've said before, like, I don't feel like an organizer, but I know that I am. You know, it's just, it doesn't feel like that, because it actually feels like you're just kind of talking to friends and getting the word out, and like you're just part of the community. Most of the work that I enjoy the most is actually the partnerships with the Lower Columbia Hispanic Council in town. And I mean, what I feel the strongest about is making sure that everybody's treated equally. And in Astoria, it's a lot of white people. You know, there is a Latino community. They're a lot bigger than I think people realize that they are, but there is a lot of separation. You know, like, it's not really crossing in community the way that I would like to see it. Anyway, we had organized a rally, and I did it in partnership with the Lower Columbia Hispanic Council. It was the first like joint rally that we both we advertised it as co-sponsoring, you know, like, it was the first real partnership. It was like a breakthrough, really. And it really was probably equal allies and members of the Latino community at the rally. You know, people were playing music, and, you know, it was a great example of kind of a culmination of trying to build this partnership. But since then, like, I feel like we're really on the same page, and like, they will call me if there's something that they want support with my group. And, you know, I'm kind of like the go-between person, but people showed up for the rally that like we had never seen before. So that felt really good.
actually haven't been around organizing as long as people might think. I've only been around for 5 years. And when I was 22 years old, so I never really cared. And I know that sounds horrible, but I really didn't. I was Latino male. I was told to just do your work, work hard, go home, take care of the family. Nothing much. I didn't have those battles when I was younger where I was up against a racist teacher or something like that. I was very reserved. I didn't care. So my first experience comes at Western Oregon, where I had to help with a presentation, actually. I had to organize a presentation about, like, undocumented students. And it was the first time I had to speak. And I was scared because I didn't understand. I was like, there's only going to be me, and no one's going to understand my story. No one's going to care about me. They just want to tokenize me. But I go into the room, and there's like 30 people that were just like me. They were DACA. They were undocumented residents. They were like non-citizens. They understood the struggle. And that was the best feeling in the world, because I was really lucky that I got to be my first experience of coming out to a large number of people. Coming out of the shadows, per se, was around people like me. And that, ever since that day, I've been emboldened to do what I can for the community. What keeps me doing this work? I mean, I got a master's in higher ed. I want to help people. And knowing that I can help my parents get a driver's license, because I started getting active in organizing when the driver's license didn't pass in 2014. And after that, I wanted to do right for my parents. I wanted to do right for them. They're still in the same area they've always lived in. So when everyone in the town where mom works likes her, but then they've all voted against the driver's license, it hurts. It really hurts. You can punk me all you want, and I will respond and I'll do my thing, but you do not treat my parents that way. You do not dehumanize them in any way. My parents sacrificed so much for me, and now I have a master's. I'm working. And as far as what keeps me going in the community too, there's another undocumented youth that their parents need the help too. What one of the touching stories of what made me keep going was when I was doing that Gausa Day of Action lobbying day in March for the HB 2015 for the driver's license. And there was a lot of people from Albany that came up. They took the day off from work, and they worked in the fields. They're like, I want to be safe. I'm here to talk to the legislators. And when field workers want to do that, when field workers want to have their whole families around, that's special. It's more special than us being young and privileged and like that we know the issues and we care and we fight, but they have everything to lose. We have a support network that knows us. We're safer. And we're not completely safe, of course, but knowing that they risked everything, that means a lot, and that's what keeps me going.
All of these organizers began by seeing a need in their community and connecting with others to build power. In this next section, we will hear Brenda and Monica both talk about meeting new people through canvassing, which is going door to door, talking with folks at their homes or businesses. While Juan highlights how engaging in elections isn't just about turning in your ballot, we begin with Brenda.
We decided to bring awareness about the Measure 105 in our area, because whenever we would bring it up to people, they didn't know what it was about, they didn't know what was going on, and that was a huge problem. We would do door-to-door canvassing. We would tell them about Measure 105, and they were pretty surprised, and then we would get them to vote, which a lot of them, it was their first time voting, and in our area, also, like, the voting is pretty low. So it was great to see that there was a lot of first-time voters, and it was good to see that it failed, because then it made them feel like they made a difference. Because I feel like, well, a lot of the things I do, because with my family, I wouldn't, with the things that I went through, I would wish like someone would have helped us through things. But then I also think of other families that are going through the same thing and probably wish like they had that same help as well, like that I want. I feel like sometimes some organizers like doing things just to get the credit, but I mean, I don't really mind about the credit. I feel like that's how I was in the beginning, well, before this, like when I first started organizing in college, like I wanted that credit, like because I would see other people getting praise and it's like, where's my praise? I did work. But now I'm glad that my mindset shifted and now I'm kind of okay with not getting that recognition, because in the end it's all about the impact that the community feels and the change that the community is feeling, and that they start feeling empowered and start taking charge.
In organizing, I've definitely had to work outside of my comfort zone a lot, but I think that I've grown the most doing it. Like, for example, canvassing, which sounds like, I mean, I guess a lot of organizers like do a ton of canvassing, but that's like not my thing at all. I will get up and lead a training, you know, I can do all that, but I don't like confrontation. So canvassing to me is really, really freaky, but I did do canvassing. And I did it like as a partnership kind of thing. It was actually with the Lower Columbia Hispanic Council. We were canvassing businesses for the No on Measure 105, and we would go in like as a pair, you know, one member of the Latino community and one ally, and going into local businesses, just trying to get them to put posters up in their windows, just so the community knew that businesses supported it. And I don't know why that was so scary for me. But I did it. But then, you know, we did it multiple times. But after the first time I did it, then, you know, I all of a sudden became like an expert. So then people are looking to me for like advice. And so I don't know. I guess you just have to put yourself out there. You have to work outside of your comfort zone sometimes, if it's something you really believe in. In terms of developing skills, ROP is always, like, if I reached out, didn't hesitate to, you know, talk me through something on the phone, or, you know, they have a caucus that go there and go to workshops or come to town and have an organizing meeting with us to kind of, you know, facilitate meetings. So that has been a huge thing for me and helped with confidence as an organizer. But don't be nervous about it. Like, you can do it. I mean, that was the biggest thing. I still do it, actually. Anything I organize, I'm like, nobody's gonna come, and like, it's just, you know, putting pressure on yourself, but people do show up, and even if it's not a lot of people, even if it's only a couple people, it did make a difference to those people. Like, that is a value too. So I don't think it always needs to be a huge turnout, because sometimes the events we've had that it's small, it actually is more meaningful, or more people get to, you know, speak up. Just do it. What brings me joy is really meeting other people, meeting people that I never would have met, you know, in other, you know, in the community, going to, you know, the Hispanic Heritage Festival, and not just being at the event because I want to show up and think it's cool, but like actually knowing people at the event, you know, or having people come to my house to have cake or what, you know, like moving to a new place and I don't have family here. It did, you know, I feel like I have family with these other organizer people.
There's a lot more people that need your help in rural areas, and they don't have the privilege to advocate for themselves, so we have to be that voice. As being a young undocumented immigrant, you're essentially the voice for your parents. That's what keeps me going. Another thing that keeps me going is that I'm part of the electoral process. I worked a lot in electoral work. One of my mentors told me, Juan, if you can't vote, get 5 people to vote. And to all those people, especially Latinx people that don't vote, think about this. When you're in a mixed status family and you vote, metaphorically, imagine that your uncle, that your tía, that your sibling, that your whatever, family members, your friends, that can't vote, you are their voice. You are their channel. And I want to get more people to vote, more people to get active in a community like that. And knowing that I'm not privileged and I can't vote, I have to fight for my human rights. But knowing that I'm privileged enough that I can be protected and I'm still be heard is why I really want to continue moving forward. There's a lot of things I would like to talk about, but I would just keep getting more emotional. I just know that as an organizer, I've always felt like I was just that derpy college student that just was saying a few things, doing some things, you know. But then when I graduate, and I see the sheer magnitude that I'm able to do alongside fantastic organizers is amazing. I am someone that cares a lot about immigration rights. And like the great Emiliano Zapata's quote, his quote is my life motto: prefiero morir de pie que vivir de rodilla. I'd rather die on my feet than live on my knees.
You're free to go.
Free.
Hold on to me.
Go.
Free. And then you go.
Go.
Who cares what they say?
Go.
Who cares what they know?
I want to go.
Hold on to me. Don't let me go.
We're free to go.
Hold on to me. Don't let me go.
I wanna go.
You're free to go.
Pharrell on KBOO Community Radio, the Free to Go remix of Freedom out in 2015. And this is the Old Mall Variety Hour. I'm going to close out this episode with a well-read red contributed by Fran Michelle, who shares this post from Kelly Hayes about the practical and emotional obstacles to organizing today and the importance of connecting with others in spite of this. Here's Fran Michelle for the Old Mall Variety Hour.
Good morning. This is Fran Michelle here recommending that the well-read Red follow the work of Kelly Hayes, whose newsletter is called Organizing My Thoughts. You might also know her from her work on the Movement Memos podcast at truthout.org, or from her co-authored book with Mariam Kaba, Let This Radicalize You. In her post titled From Aspiration to Action, Organizing Through Exhaustion, Grief, and Uncertainty, Hayes explores what holds people back from organizing in order to help more of us act at this crucial time. She notes that some obstacles are material, like the demands of childcare and survival work. Some obstacles concern safety, like the lack of COVID precautions in most spaces. And some obstacles arise from alienation, moral injury, and despair. But she points to ways to move toward a variety of actions and the importance of doing so. Here are some excerpts from that post. I've added a few summarizing phrases to stitch together these excerpts, but most of the words that follow are Hayes. There is a common admonition that often circulates on social media that goes something like, "You don't have to ask what you would have done during the Holocaust, you're doing it right now." These words are valuable in that they encourage us to abandon fantasies of who we would have been in another context and to live our values here and now. Fantasies about who we would have been and what we would have done in moments of profound injustice allow us to imagine braver, more purposeful versions of ourselves. But when we're confronted with the reality of catastrophic injustice in the world around us, we are forced to measure those fantasies against reality. The results can be profoundly depressing. It's easy to pass judgment on ourselves and each other for what we're already doing or failing to do. But as an organizer, I'm concerned with what might motivate or allow people to act differently. After all, the people whose actions we have admired during historical moments of resistance, rebellion, and rescue were not simply born into heroic collective action. They had to find their way, just as many of us must now find our way through this moment. So, what's holding us back? Recently, I've talked with many people who feel like they're not showing up for this moment in the ways they had hoped or imagined. For some, the disparity between aspiration and practice is rooted in practical concerns, being overwhelmed by childcare and the basics of survival under capitalism. For others, their reluctance is tied to safety concerns, such as a lack of COVID precautions in our movements. Still others feel demoralized and unsure of what meaningful actions they can take. For some people, the problem stems from a sense of alienation or feeling betrayed or abandoned by past organizing experiences. Aaron Goggins, an organizer with the Wild Seed Society, believes that alienation, coupled with grief and unprocessed trauma, is a major factor in the political hesitancy many activists are experiencing. He believes that mass protest in 2020 and the solidarity fostered through mutual aid helped push Trump out of office, but argues that activists and organizers were never given the opportunity to meaningfully process those events. When Biden took office, the national focus on restoring normalcy shut down any meaningful analysis of what was gained or lost in the streets, what had been built through mutual aid, and what people had lost due to COVID and the violence of organized abandonment. The transition from fighting for each other and endeavoring to support one another to abandoning any catharsis, grieving process, or regard for disabled people, whose lives were immediately threatened by the end of widespread COVID safety precautions, created a kind of emotional and political dissonance. Aaron emphasized that the disposability of essential workers, disabled people, and Black people, given that anti-Black police violence seemed to fall off the radar for most liberals after Trump left office, created a moral injury in our society. People have been disoriented by brutal news cycles, relentless lies, and attacks on human decency and the very fabric of our shared reality. To overcome this, we are going to have to find ways to welcome disoriented people into the fray. Aaron emphasizes that people are not going to show up equipped to do everything that the moment demands of them and will not always act in ways we appreciate or that make sense to us. We're going to have to recognize that all of the mental strategies that people use, from catastrophizing to ad hominem attacks or anti-intellectualism, some of that is just a trauma response. And so projects that help explain to people what's happening in ways their nervous systems can handle, that's what's going to help people make collective sense of the moment. Because if we can't have a shared reality and a shared agreement on what is happening, it's very hard to learn any lessons collectively. On an individual level, choosing how to engage and deciding how much we can contribute remains complicated. Some people will be constrained by their everyday responsibilities, such as childcare, or by their community's refusal to address concerns, such as COVID safety. Whatever holds us back, we still need to find ways to connect and participate in collective struggle, because isolation will not save us. For the sake of safety planning, coordination, fellowship, and building power, we all need to be part of something larger than ourselves. None of us can do what this moment requires of us in isolation. If local in-person gatherings are not accessible, virtual discussions, support, and planning groups might be better options for some people. Structure-based organizing, like labor and tenants unions, will be especially vital in the months and years ahead, and these formations are well worth joining, building, and supporting. If you're not ready to unionize your building, consider forming a text thread to discuss emergencies and safety concerns to establish a sense of connectedness with your neighbors. If large membership organizations or local mutual aid groups aren't a good fit, consider forming a discussion group. Reading and discussing resources like the Defend and Recruit Playbook or Mariam Kaba's Making a Plan zine might help your group find a sense of direction or shared purpose. If you're worried about being adequately supported and want to support others in these uncertain times, care webs and pod mapping are also meaningful activities that can help strengthen the connective tissue that has been weakened for so many of us in recent years. Whatever it takes to stage a mental jailbreak, escape our isolation, and forge bonds with other people, including people we don't particularly like or want to get to know, but who we are willing to fight for, care for, and protect, this is how we will survive these times. The work of assessing our capacities and potentially taking a chance on a new group or project may be intimidating, but we have to remember what's at stake. Our contributions to the groups and organizations we join or establish may feel small at times. That's okay. The truth is that all of our capacities vary over time. Perhaps the first thing we need to acknowledge to ourselves is that nothing will feel like enough because everything we know and love is at stake. No individual's actions will be commensurate with the threats we face. But we can each endeavor to do the next right thing. We must do what we can while we can, because our time is running out. The question before us is not who we would have been in a different era, but what we are willing to do now, in concert with others, before it's too late. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Fran Michelle, reading from Kelly Hayes' post on organizing through exhaustion, grief, and uncertainty. You can read the whole on her newsletter, Organizing My Thoughts.
This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour for the 4th of August, 2025. I'm John Nelson. Thanks to Fran Michelle, Courtney Neubauer with Rural Roots Rising, and Desiree Helliger and her guest Tim Norgren. You can find this episode alongside other archived episodes of the Old Mole in time at kboo.fm just search for the Old Mull Variety Hour. Suggestions, comments, or questions can be sent from the KBOO website at kboo.fm.
This is Ray Lynn, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.